Welcome to RPG Ramblings with Jeff Jones. This is a weekly show exploring the various details of the tabletop RPG hobby through discussions with interesting people. Today, Onslaught 6 joins me. He's one of the writers for Gary's Appendix, whose articles are as interesting as his moniker is mysterious. We move past the veil and we discuss cool things that he made and the fun projects slated for the future. Suggest you check out his website and take a listen to some of the songs he recorded. The bounty's on the move. Sisters and brothers, it is time to get rambling. Hello, Onslaught 6.
What up?
Well, I don't know. I have learned since knowing you that I can't tell the difference between Onslaught 6, Onslaught 6, and Onslaught 6.
Yeah, my branding is very particular, and I get upset.
What's funny is I really can't see the difference, even though there is a difference. And that's what threw me off so much. And it's like, I don't know. And I can't scratch my head why I can't see that putting a number six and the word
is like
six,
different than the word.
No, not yeah. That for you, but why for me,
it doesn't register at all as being a different thing.
Yeah.
There's probably some like dyslexia, dyscalculia type of thing in there somewhere, or I'm just an idiot.
No, you're not an idiot. But what's interesting is it is like the Death Star, that trench or whatever that they shoot that missile into. Mm-hmm. Well, I found out that's the weakness is Onslaught 6. I can't tell the difference. It's all capitalized or not. If it's a number six or the letter six, it all looks the same to me.
I came up with this name in 2002. So for 21 years, I've been seeing people screw it up. So it's nothing I'm not used to seeing.
Well, it's like a continuing Mandela effect, I think. Like Berenstain Bears?
Because you just, like, when you come back, you're like, wait, what was it? I don't
know. It's like. So anyway, you've done some work for Gary's Appendix.
Yeah.
And but you're busy right now, from what I can tell.
Yeah, we are really busy down here. We just released, finally, after a whole year after Kickstarter, we got Ceres, the Planet That Never Sleeps. This is my new supplement for my game, CU Space Cowboy. It's a 40-page setting and bounty module for our 90s anime-inspired sci-fi jazz fusion bounty hunter tabletop RPG, CU Space Cowboy. But you can actually use it in other RPG systems, too, because it's so lightweight and simple. We actually have rules right here on page 3 for using it with Stars Without Number and Mothership and Tony from Plus One EXP's Through the Void.
Oh, nice. So as a previous title, CU Space Cowboy Bebop?
CU Space Cowboy is our main core rulebook. It's our main game. It's a tabletop role-playing game for 3 players set in outer space. 3+ players, it should
3 say. 3+ players.
Yeah, yeah. You need at least 2 people and a GM. I have run it with like GM and 1 player, and it's really, you can do it, but it gets a little like your options become a little limited because of how the characters are laid out.
Well, I think in general, I know there are probably role-playing games that are specifically meant for, one-on-one playing, but I think in general, 2's a minimum. You need a minimum of 2.
Yeah.
To really have, to get the full role-playing experience, I think.
Yeah, because I think just party composition-wise, when you have at least 2 players, they can bounce ideas off of each other, and they can solve more problems than just a single character could. Because usually, as a single character, you have to specialize or at least be kind of good at like one or 2 things.
Yeah, I think also allows for people to disagree. I think we should go here. Well, I think we should go here.
Yeah, also.
You know, it's like, so that really kind of brings a little bit more flavor rather than just I don't know what is with one person. But
helps the GM because then they don't have to bring as much to the table. Like the more players you have, I kind of feel like the less weight that the GM actually needs to carry the momentum of the game.
Yeah, because sometimes you can just leave the room for a half an hour and they continue going.
I have done that. I've been like, okay, you guys argue about what you're going to do. I'm going to go get a piece of pizza and I'll be back.
It is kind of funny what becomes a mini game. It's just sometimes just the funny antics between players. So wouldn't you say that Sea Space Cowboy, when was that released?
We ran the Kickstarter in February of 2021, and it came out in February 2022.
Okay.
And we've been working on it ever since. And then Saris, we ran the Kickstarter in August of last year, and we just fulfilled it. Actually, I'm still fulfilling it. I have boxes of packages that I need to send out once some stuff gets resolved.
So when you did the Kickstarter, because you know people do these differently. So what stage were you at when you had the Kickstarter?
So I had the full base text of the game, which I would say compromises about 50% of this book.
Okay.
Yeah, basically almost exactly 50%. And I was a first-time developer. I had never released anything in the tabletop RPG sphere. I had never done anything for 5e or any other D&D stuff that I had released publicly. I'd never done anything. So I knew I was coming in as a like fresh-faced designer that anybody who would see the Kickstarter wouldn't know me from Adam, right? And so they were going to need something, some degree of product there to show that I at least have the confidence that I can design a game, and here's what I have, and if this seems like it's something you're interested in, go ahead and take it. And so I had an Ashcan release, which was just Google Docs in two-column format. It was just a Google Doc that I exported as a PDF. And I had already commissioned our cover art out of pocket, and I had commissioned one of our artists out of pocket to do like three pieces of art for it.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And how well did it do? Do you remember?
We made like $2,600.
That's pretty good. And then probably at that price, there's a lot of backers too to get that.
Yeah, it was about 200 backers.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty good. It is surprising how because Scoundrels was kind of a summer situation for me, and that I had no idea, I threw something out there, but I think I had the fortune of going live during the Kickstarter during COVID. So I think everybody was just buying.
Right.
It was crazy. So that helped. But I do find it kind of interesting that a nobody can just throw something out there. And as long as it looks semi-professional and people will back it.
Yeah, I think that was what it was. Part of what it was, I ran it during Zine Quest in early 2021, and I think people during those kind of events are more willing to throw a couple bucks and see what shakes out and what sticks than they are other times of the year. Because if there's 50, let's just say, projects, you know, some degree of them are going to fail, and some of them are going to turn out to be, maybe this isn't what I wanted when I pledged for it, and then some of them are going to be hits, right? There have been a few of those that are like that, but I believed in the idea, and you know, I wanted to see somebody else's dream come true, so I threw the money in. And even if it turns out and I get the thing and I start reading and I go, oh, actually this isn't what I wanted, that happens sometimes. And you just have to, what I philosophically wanted to do, I wanted to minimize that for people. I wanted people who took a chance on this to at least be able to read most of the rules and be able to see, oh, this is something that I am interested in. And like I said, this person seems to know what they're doing, and they've already got some art. They've all got it put together. Now, at that time, it was just a Google Doc. I did not know how to do any layout at all. I had never done it. And I had planned on having a friend of mine do the layout. And then very shortly after the Kickstarter, it became obvious they weren't going to be able to do that. And so I had to just buy Affinity and start from scratch and learn how to do layout by myself. And it turns out I'm pretty good at it, I think.
Yeah, I think the main thing with it is, I mean, there are certain rules, you know, as far as, I mean, knowing how to use the software, you know, like layers and things. But I think a lot of the stuff, there are some really good YouTube videos. I don't know if you take advantage of those, but they kind of talk about basics of layout and font choice and things like that.
I didn't do any of that. I just went in blind and went, I think I have a pretty good eye for this. I mean, I used to sort of lay out everything for my band, but I didn't do layout software. I just used Photoshop. I didn't even know that layout software existed. And so I would get frustrated, like trying to lay out the lyrics for the booklet and be like, if these two words could just get closer together.
If only there was a way.
If only there was a way. And as soon as I got Affinity and learned that, oh, you just adjust the tracking and then they go a little bit closer and nobody's the wiser. If I had had that 15 years ago, maybe my music career wouldn't have failed.
The tracking killed my music career.
That's a joke. Nobody bought my music because it was bad, not because the lyrics weren't properly formatted.
Yeah, it is pretty funny though. I do like that. I really do like that. That was true. You know what I mean? It's like everybody, for whatever reason, whatever those two words were, it just everybody says, no, this isn't cool. I don't know what's wrong with this, but something just bothered me, and it comes to be that just that 25% on the tracking would have made all the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I did is originally I started with some little stuff, but then I actually. Paid my daughter was taking a graphic design course, and I paid the professor to look it over and just give me critiques. And
yeah, you could do that. I mean, I have always had a bunch of people who are artistically minded and have eyes for things that I've always just thrown them stuff and be like, hey, is this good? And a lot of the time they will see things that I don't see, because when you're working on something, you can get so deep in it that you just have blinders on and don't see things.
I think what helped me with this particular fellow is he had some particular rules that you always follow, or he always wanted. I mean, you could break him, but I think I at least was set down with thou shall not, thou shall not, thou shall not, or thou shall. And it's like, once I understood that there's that structure I can follow, and then it's a matter of kind of wiggling things around within that structure, and things generally work out. So there's no Morkborg layout in my future. It's going to stay.
there's a little bit of that. I think it's there. Yeah. I have a Morkborg style book in me. I just don't know what the subject matter would be yet.
Yeah, I know the feeling. It won't be that for me, but I've probably mentioned it before in the podcast. I would like to just do a traditional style layout with like cutting and taping and pasting and photocopying. Oh,
like actually old school do it.
Yeah, and then scan it in and then print
I think Logar is doing some stuff with that over at he used to be Wobblies and Wizards. I think it's Hobo Collective now.
Yeah, and Logar is he's a great fellow, love him. I really liked Wobblies and Wizards, and I especially liked it with John Gilmore. But things have gone on, it's fine, but Logar's just a great guy. Started a printing business and is trying out all sorts of things, and also bringing back his art too, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, go for it.
So in this podcast, I really mostly, even though things do kind of get political maybe a little bit now and then with certain topics, but with Logar being an avowed anarchist, I've really just been dying to have him on just to like explore exactly what does it mean. But maybe I'll start a branch off podcast, not RPG ramblings. Maybe political ramblings. I don't know. So I think there's a lot of opportunities. A lot of people do some really interesting things. And I also think with the Dungeon 23, people have been doing writing in notebooks, and my goodness, some of that scritchy, scratchy stuff people are putting in their notebooks and sharing just looks pretty wonderful to me. I got
mine downstairs.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I'm one of the last like five people still doing it, I think.
It's hard.
I just do it at my lunch break on work is how I ended up sticking with it. Like there's a lot of motivation when today's room is between you and your meal.
Right.
Like I'll come back in and to lunch at work. I'll put my thing in the microwave or whatever I need to do. And I will take it out and I will sit it in front of me and I will take out the notebook and I will say, you're not allowed to touch this food until you fill out today's room.
That's a great idea. And for me, it'd be a good way of losing weight. Yeah, it's. I think those type of creative projects are really good. I just did not do it because I knew I did not have it in me to dedicate that space of time. But
it really only takes about 5 minutes. But
well,
you know, I mean, formatting it into something else, that's the real kicker. I've been trying to get mine every month on Patreon, but I'm a couple months behind just because I have to. You know, I have to remake the maps. I can't just scan my scribblings in there. So I have to remake the maps, and then I have to put numbers on the maps, and then I have to do the whole thing.
It would take me more than 5 minutes. I'd actually try and complete something that's cohesive.
You just need one room. You just need one room. What's in the room today?
Yeah. Well,
I printed out one of the spreads from Ben Milton's Maze Rats. That is just the dungeon rooms and traps page. And if I'm ever stuck for something, I just pull that out of the back of the notebook and I look at it and I go, that one, and I write that down.
Yeah, I think that I think there definitely is there's value in that just writing something down and just the exercise is good. I would want to have something, if I'm going to be putting that much time into it, I want something at the end. It's like, and for me, that would mean probably spending way too much time because there's some things I'm efficient at and there's some things I am terribly inefficient at. And sitting and thinking of things to stock a room is not my level, is not something I'm proficient at. But maybe if I would just do a room a day, I would be more proficient at the end of the year.
Yeah, so. That's the thing. You very quickly figure out what your skills are and what your not skills are in that realm when you're doing it that much. I mean, at 5 minutes a day, we're like 250 days into the year now. That's a couple hours of experience, technically.
Yeah, yeah. For me, like I said, I couldn't do it in 5 minutes. I know how I am. It'd probably take me at least 20 minutes or half an hour for me to do it. But that's
fair enough. We all have our own strengths and weaknesses. I think a good part of my philosophy about GMing is figuring out what you can improvise off the top of your head and what you absolutely 100% have to prep ahead of time. I don't ever prep room descriptions. Like what's in the room, like if there's a monster or treasure or furniture or it's a kitchen, whatever, I can just write a kitchen. And then when the players walk in there, I can describe to you as if it's the finest TSR boxed text, a kitchen with, and if the players ask questions and stuff like that, I can riff off of that and I can create this whole detailed kitchen off the top of my head. Do not ask me the name of the guy who runs the kitchen because I'm going to freeze up and have no idea. So what I've learned is I need to prep names. I need to prep stuff like that.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. For me, no, I'm terrible at that. In fact, I think, for me, what works best is the old school essentials formatting for room descriptions is the best for me because it provides bolded. It's rather terse, but it also has in the parentheses some extra details that I can expound upon if necessary.
Right.
But I think that's, for me, that works well, probably the best. It seems like sometimes I actually do like box texts, but sometimes it just seems to go on too long.
Yeah, I actually don't like box text at all because it never feels like I'm saying it, and it too often seems like it's just written for the GM to say, and then the players don't ever interact with it at all.
Well, I prefer my
rooms are more like a conversation between the players and me.
Well, and I agree with you there because I ran an adventure. And I was given a module at a convention that was written by somebody else, and I just realized it was just nothing but a lot of narrative thrown up, or exposition I should say, and it's just like No, it's just like old school essentials. You see this, you see this, you see this. Then you tell
especially
me what
if
you
you're
do.
At a con game and you maybe only have like an hour and a half or 2 hours to run it.
Yeah, I think that I think I'm a terse but descriptive. See, I'm not good at being terse and I'm not good at being descriptive, and I'm probably also not good at being, and I'm probably too terse. So I need something that's a something that you're good at is being eloquent at a moment's notice, describe a room where for me, I fail. It's like, it's a kitchen. Okay. but I think we're, you know, what you're saying is you, and I think describing a kitchen's great, but also like old school essentials where they just kind of just state what's in there. And then it's up to the players to then interact with what they see and ask further questions. And I can see both advantages to both of those approaches.
Yeah. Like I said, it's just, it's figuring out what you're good at and what other people need.
Yeah. Cause there's
writing an adventure is hard. I don't know if I've ever succeeded in doing that really.
In writing an adventure. I think I'm better at fixing other people's adventures to work at my table than I am actually probably writing anything. So it's just like, you know what? Maybe you ought to put all the room description stuff all together and then not sprinkle it out through all the text. So I kind of enjoy reformatting existing adventures into a way that it's usable for me. But then again, it may not be usable for anybody else. So so series of plant that never sleeps. So this was, are you going to come
up with a series? It's interesting that you pronounced it that way.
I can't help it.
Everybody pronounces, this is a running joke on our podcast. Everybody pronounces it different and there's no consistency and I don't correct anybody.
I think it's because it makes me think of Cerebus.
Okay.
And I think that's why it comes out Ceres. I think Cerebus every time I see it.
Okay.
But the problem is Cerebus, I don't think it's pronounced Cerebus.
Yeah, Cerebus is the aardvark. You're Cerberus.
Oh, you're going dog. To Dave Sims. I keep thinking Cerebus is the three-headed dog, but I think I'm mispronouncing it.
No, that's Cerberus, dude.
See, I've been mispronouncing it. So I think the Dave Sims comic has infiltrated my brain as a virus and has rewritten. So now I know another blind spot. So I guess
I cut you off. You were going to say something.
Oh, no, I don't know. It's okay. I don't know. Oh, so you're going to do other planets is the idea of different planets to fit in this setting?
In the core rulebook, we do detail the entire solar system. Ceres is actually a real asteroid that's in our solar system. It's a dwarf planet. I think it's about the size of Pluto and was partially responsible for why Pluto got reclassified as a dwarf planet. Because I think Ceres technically qualifies as a dwarf planet because it's so big. It's like the largest asteroid in the entire solar system. And that, to me, meant it would be the smallest possible planet to set something on. And so when I was creating the setting guide in the original CU Space Cowboy rulebook, I mean, I detailed everything. Just a short little paragraph, but I said, Ceres is so small that it's self-contained. They were able to terraform the whole thing into city. So it's the whole planet wide, just city. And that gave me a really good base to build off of. And when I was running the game, it started as a playtest and then became our actual play podcast. I mostly just set it on Ceres just to build out the world and figure it out. And we had originally, Ceres was going to be a stretch goal for the original Kickstarter, and it got blown out of proportion because I talked to my friend Made of Tin, who is the co-writer on the book, and I was like, maybe write up a couple paragraphs of stuff. You're a good writer. You're a world builder. That's like what you do normally. And they were like, well, how many? I was like, I don't know, 36 would be a good number for the whole thing. How big could that possibly be? Right? And I figured I would write like 2/3 of them and they would write the rest. And I went to bed and a week went by and there were 36 locations written. And then with as much as they had written, I was kind of like, oh, this isn't going to be a little like 8-page pamphlet.
No.
Which is what I thought it would be. It blew up to be 40 pages long. Once I had started laying it out and figuring it out and everything. And originally we had thought about maybe doing every planet Or like two planets in like a 32-page book, so 16 pages for this one, 16 for that one. But after seeing how much work Ceres was, and with all of the artwork and everything we had to build, that's really not feasible for continuing the line. That, and as it's been like 2 years that we've been working on this so far, and so we have a lot of ideas for what we want to do. The next thing we're doing is a cybernetics catalog for the book, which is going to let you get like cyber arms and cyber torsos and cyber brains with lots of upgrades that let you be better at things. And we're going to have an adventure anthology, which is just a book of like 12 one-shots that are all going to fit on, if you printed them out, they would just fit on the front and back of a regular page, but there'll be like two-page spreads in the book. And so then after that, we're basically going to call it quits.
So, Ceres, is that a zine format, digest format?
Yes, it's zine format, just like CU Space Cowboy. I think all of my books that we ever do are going to be that. Because I just, look how cute they are.
Well, I think they hold in the hand. They fit very nicely. Yeah, I know some people are against the smaller formats, but I actually find, especially working at the table, to be much more convenient.
Yeah, I bought the Lost Dungeons of Tonusberg by the Secrets of Blackmore guys.
Yeah.
And it came in, and that's like a soft cover, like 8.5 by 11. And it was huge. And I was like, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So, the system for that, what kind of system mechanics do you use for CU Space Cowboy?
So CU Space Cowboy, it started as a mothership hack, because I was running mothership for my friends. And what I discovered about myself is, as much as I love mothership and wish that I could be true to it, I am not a mean enough GM for it. Like I couldn't kill the players.
Right.
Like I would throw monsters against them, and I would play everything 100% by the book. And I wasn't 100% sure on how often they should be rolling panic checks or taking on stress and stuff like that. So maybe I was a little too nice on that front. And then they rolled really well to kill the monster. And I was like, okay, the monster's dead. I guess the horror is over, you know? And I was just like, I'm too nice for this. I love the vibe of it and all of that. And the base system was good for me. How do I make this into something? How do I push the vibe of this less into sci-fi horror and maybe into like sci-fi good times, for lack of a better term? And Cowboy Bebop came to mind. I'm a big fan of the anime, and just the idea of a couple of ragtag losers who are always broke, flying around in their spaceship, hunting bad guys to get money, immediately struck me as a good campaign premise for a mothership game. And then I immediately took the character sheet and started figuring out, okay, what minor tweaks do I have to do to this to make it less horror and more like having a good time and screwing around.
So what did you come up with for that?
Well, I kind of kept the stats the same, and I had to get rid of saves. And once I was screwing around with it, I was like, I don't know if I like percentile systems and rolling under. Roll under is kind of a bugbear for me. It's just like, I roll under always feels bad for me in a game. Like, to me, higher numbers should be better. I understand the math of it and why it works, and I'll gladly play in or run a game that's roll under, but it's just like, if I'm making the thing, I couldn't get behind roll under. So I started looking at some other ways I could do this, and Powered by the Apocalypse came up, because that's one of the, you know, next most suggestions that people have. And so I started looking at, okay, it's 2d6. Every roll is 2d6. That's great. I played with that a little bit. And then what I decided was, I just decided to be weird. And I got rid of 2d6 and I replaced it with one dice. And what it is you assign to your four stats. You have muscles, moves, brains, and cool, which the names are stolen from the old West End Games Ghostbusters RPG, which is the first RPG I ever played. And you assign a D6, a D8, a D10, and a D12 to your stats. So you might have D6 brains, but D12 cool.
Right.
And so the PBTA success, partial success, and failure mechanic, the distribution of those is, I think it's 6 or 7 is a partial success all the way to 9. And I adjusted those numbers a little bit, so it was like 5 is a partial success and above, and 10 and above is a full success. Because it was easier for me to remember 1, 5, and 10. And it seems like it's easier for the players to remember that. So once I had that, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. No,
I think I had that, there had to be a way for you, because if you only have, if your lowest one is a D6, that means you can never, you only have a 1 in 6 chance, or 1 in 2 in 6 chance of partially succeeding, and you have no way to fully succeed if a full success is 10. So I didn't really invent them. I stole them from Ghostbusters. I added the talents. And what talents are is they let you add a D4 to your roll, but they're just a sentence that's associated with your stat. And it can be whatever you want. It can be as broad or as specific as you want for that. And I always say this is the example I give in the book. If you want your moves talent to be, or I guess it's muscles, yeah. Yeah, so if it's muscles talent, you could write kicking down a door. And now if you're kicking down a door, you get to roll whatever your muscles is and a D4. But if you write kicking, now you can kick a door, you can kick a dog, and you can kick someone's ass.
Okay. So you add the D6 and the D4 in that situation?
Right. And then you would get it, and then you have a range of anywhere from 2 to 10.
So, but I guess in that case, it makes your worst stats sometimes maybe your best, not quite your best, but
it depends on the distribution. About an equal chance. Yeah, it helps the distribution out. And because you're doing that, it gives it more of a bell curve than just rolling one dice standard.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have, your equipment can give you like +1 or +2 to different things. Like if you have a good enough gun and stuff, you basically can't not partially succeed.
So gunfights can be very deadly.
Well, no, because one of the things is that, and this is anathema to some people, but nobody can die in CU Space Cowboy. You just can't die. I just decided, what if you couldn't die? If you ever take more than 5 hits, you go unconscious and you have to go to the hospital for a couple weeks. And the bounty's going to get away and everything goes to shit, right? Because in the anime, this is spoilers for a 25-year-old anime, the main character dies at the end of the show. And it's only because that is the most narratively satisfying way for him to go out. And it's actually even kind of ambiguous whether he actually dies or not. People still debate that to this day. But earlier in the show, he falls out a window, he flies through space without a helmet on, he goes through all this stuff, and the worst that ever happens to him is at the end of the episode, he's covered in bandages. Right. And then at the beginning of the next episode, he's fine. Right?
Yeah, and I think the thing is that, you know, some people will, especially on Twitter, will go to great lengths to describe just how messed up the world is without being able to have character death in an RPG. And I'm constantly amazed at how much energy people put into being upset over the possibility of a game being out there where a person may never die, a character may never die.
It's all about the genre that you're trying to capture.
Exactly.
In like a heavy, grimdark dungeon crawl game that feels like Dark Souls, yeah, I absolutely understand why dying is important and should be on the table. And in most D&D games, I understand why that would be. Now, I run, even though I mostly run 5th edition for my home group, because that's what they know, and we're just trying to play out our campaigns until we're done with them at this point. Character death is still on the table there. It's just relatively easy to get resurrected. They just have to pay a bunch of money and know a couple people.
Well, but see, that's, to me, is the irony of it all. Is the people that complain, they play systems where resurrection is a possibility.
It's right there. It's right there in the rule book.
And I'm thinking, if you think it is so wimpish, why do you allow potions of healing?
Yeah, like, that's
why do you allow clerics to heal? If you really want that gritty, it's like, so they complain about something that they actually imbibe themselves. So it's like, But I think the idea is going back to the Power by Apocalypse is they emulate, and also Cortex Plus, another one I really enjoy, that emulates genre. And that's where the joy is, right? You want to play in this genre.
Yeah. Like I said, Ghostbusters was the first game I ever, the first role-playing game I ever played. And right there in those rules, it says Ghostbusters can't die. Nobody's going to die in a Ghostbusters movie. That's just not the way it is, right? They're going to get hurt really bad, and then they're going to go to the hospital, and they're going to be fine, and they're going to be like, well, hope that doesn't happen again.
But what would be good is if you know, I think the problem is people see that death as really the only high stake. But if characters or players are invested in the setting, you could equate failure with other bad things happening to things they care about in the setting.
Dude, just the bounty getting away because one of your guys was down is basically like that's the worst failure that you can have in CU Space Cowboy because it means you don't get paid for the job. And CU Space Cowboy doesn't have levels. You just get more money and then you upgrade your gear and that lets you do more like stuff better. And it also lets you pay off your debt if you have one because you have to have a debt or you have to have a regret in your past. And so, you know, the guy getting away, that's your meal ticket. That's your XP for the day. He's just gone, and you're not going to be able to get him again. Or we're going to have to come back next week after Bobby gets healed up and, you know, go for it again. And he's not worth any more because he got away. He's still worth the same amount, so we're still chasing the same thing.
Or maybe now he's going to get his buddies. Now he's coming after you.
Yeah, that's the thing. Now, next time he's probably going to have bodyguards.
Yeah, it's not so easy this next time. And I think that's where, you know, there's a lot of opportunities within role-playing games to reward players, you know, by, you know, different means, including just having, you know, a fun narrative experience.
Yeah, it depends on what everybody's there for.
Yeah, I played, have you ever played Golden Sky Stories?
I have never even heard of that. What is that?
So it's based off of, I guess some sort of Japanese, I think it's a Japanese RPG. This person ran from this young person, and you're basically either these Japanese monsters or spirits, and you try and help somebody. And so the whole story is just like, you know, somebody's lost something, and the whole game is you just helping somebody in the most. A lot of times it's very minor way, but it's not something I love, but actually having played it a couple times, it's like, it is kind of fun to do on occasion, right? I mean, not every adventure has to have huge stakes. Sometimes you're just, you know, it's good to be able to experience different things and to feel different emotions. And I think try out different, you know, RPG muscles, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. This looks cute as hell.
It is. It is. You can't be mean. You can't do anything bad. And everybody's very supportive. And if you do get enough of these, I can't remember, dreams or wishes or whatever, you power up and you get to do something pretty cool. And so one game I was actually, one of the monsters is it's an umbrella that has like but it's got like a leg of a creature.
Yeah, that's like a classic Japanese yokai monster.
Yeah, so that was that for one of these. So, but my point is, even going back to your dread of killing off characters, where I think you know what could be the problem is that for you may be very good for doing on a one shot, but for a campaign you don't want to be that kind of GM. But maybe
even
for a one shot,
one shots I had problems doing it. Run one shot, and I would literally say, we're never going to use these characters again, so don't get attached because they might die. And then everybody came out unscathed, and I was like... The weird thing is, I couldn't do that for Mothership. I ran OSE for my friends on an off night because one guy couldn't make it. And I think I killed like four characters. So I don't know what the deal is.
Maybe they're just
Reginald. Rest in peace, Reginald.
I do find it kind of ironic. I ran some old school adventures for these people at a convention, and someone who made up the character sheets, you know, they gave everybody maximum hit points and all that, and I was like, do you want the real experience? So I had them, they're like, sure. So I had them roll, and they're like third level, and they had they hired a henchman that were first level that had more hit points than they did.
Yeah, Reginald was our magic user in that party. He survived three expeditions into the Caves of Chaos. He had just made it to level 3, and he had 4 hit points. and so they go in the Goblin Cave, and there were 2 of them that went after him, and the player's response, was to try and bail. And so it was like, if you bail, they're going to like get a whole extra turn on you before you get out of there. And he was like, they could miss. I'm like, you have like negative AC, dude. He was like, they could miss. It's fine. They did not miss. And that's where Reginald met his end.
Oh, alas. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. So, I'm going to try pronouncing it right. I got to look at it. Cirrus, right? Cirrus? Is that how you pronounced it?
I say Cirrus, but it really doesn't matter.
I still can't. Okay, so Cirrus, and you said you're going to do an equipment guide. You're also going to do a bunch. Oh, I know where I was going. So you're going to also do those one-shot adventures.
Yes.
So those would probably work then, I would assume. How well would those work for, you think, other RPGs?
Well, they're all focused on hunting a bounty, obviously, except a couple of them might not. So the thing about CU Space Cowboy is, because it's like basically the PBTA framework, enemies don't have nearly as many stats as you would require for another game. So let me just look here. Like in the back of Cirrus, we have 18 bounties, and they all fit on... 6 of them will fit on a 2-page spread here.
Oh, okay.
And they're basically just these little ID cards. And the main thing that every bounty has is they have a threat level, which is basically an equivalent of how many successes that the party needs to accrue against them in order to subdue them or kill them if they choose. But they're worth less money if they kill them. Well, so if somebody's a threat level 4, you need 4 successes or 8 partial successes or some combination thereof in order to take them down. And so that is a real easy analog, and we don't provide any of the other stuff. You're basically supposed to roll on random tables that we've included in order to help flesh out the bounty, such as, like, what kind of stuff is this guy carrying? Do they have, like, a briefcase that turns into an Uzi? Do they have a flamethrower? Do they have a jetpack? Do they have stuff like that? And you can sort of figure that out on the fly, and that kind of determines what environment they're in. But, so, like, trying to run that in another system, it's just a matter of, we have threat level 1 to 6. So how easy are some enemies in your system and how hard are some in your system? You could basically transport this right into like Stars Without Number or Cities Without Number, the new cyberpunk one, and be like, this is a 6 hit dice guy, right? Yeah. And right there, we've all run an old school game. We know what a 6 hit die guy is like, right? Or for Mothership, you can be like, this guy has 6, I think they call them hits now. I haven't read any of the first edition Mothership stuff because I'm waiting for my box to get here.
You and I think 1,342 other people.
Listen, man, making games is hard.
It is. It is. Somebody was saying, you know, as much as people complain, I did not back it. But they said that, you know, they're still well within the period of time that they, I think, for the Kickstarter. They're not past the promise date or the commit date or whatever that's called.
So I don't think that's true, but I'm not gonna give him shit for it.
Well, as long as it's good, I suppose.
Yeah, I know it's gonna be good because I have everything for the 0th edition, and I did peek in their new intro module when the PDFs came out. I just kind of skimmed through it and went, yeah, this looks really good.
Yeah, in fact, I'm thinking about moving. Very likely going to look at taking Scoundrels of Brixton and moving that to Mothership, seeing how that goes. I've been using the Cephas engine, which is basically Traveler, but it'd be interesting to see if there can gain a little more traction using another system.
Yeah. But also going back to your thing, we did have a, we had sort of planned that the solar system would get detailed out. And we are still kind of doing that in the one shots. I've written a bunch of them so far. And we kind of try to set them on planets that aren't Ceres. So that, like, you're not going to get a whole 40 page book about like Ganymede, for instance, but you'll get an adventure set on it. And that'll sort of give you enough of the vibe that you can go, oh, I see what they're going for here. I can do this.
Yeah, it's and that's where it's kind of the whole, you know, trying to find that balance with keeping things light, keeping things from getting too heavy, but yet providing enough information.
Yeah,
and that's always kind of a interesting balance to try and pull off.
You want to give the GM enough that they can run the thing and expand on it if they want to, but not give them so much that they're weighed down by it and worried that if they change something or alter it, it's gonna screw everything up.
I'm trying to see if I can find Mothership, but I think you have to go way back, don't you, to find Mothership.
In your Kickstarter stuff?
Or? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it launched in, I was in this house. So somewhere in like early 2022. Yes, in fact, I remember being mad because they were launching at a certain point and I wanted to launch something then. And I was like, damn it.
So Hull Breach was after Mothership, right?
I think so. I did not get that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I may.
I'll say this. After a certain point, I was like, well, I'm not buying any new Mothership stuff until I get my box. And so that means that there's like a year's worth of stuff that I was just like, well, I'm not buying that.
Well, that saves you. Then all of a sudden, then you're going to go through a great big purchasing
the Mothership
frenzy.
Haul.
You said it started. When did it? You said it was 20.
I don't know. 2021. I'm not sure.
I'm just kind of curious now. 2021. So it's been almost 2 years. There's a Mothership restaurant. Oh, there we go. There we go. First edition box set. You're right. They are. Oh wait, that's a digital edition. They're saying.
Yeah, that's out. All the PDFs are out.
Yeah, you're right. They're way past.
Funded successfully December 22nd, 2021.
Yeah, they're supposed to estimate delivery was November 2022. So they are going on a year late.
That's okay. I'm sure it'll be great.
That's tough.
I trust them.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. They were updating like 5 or 6 books and adding 2 or 3 extra ones because there's the monster book and the ship book and a DM's guide plus a whole nother adventure they were doing. I mean, doing 3 or 4 new books in like a year's worth of time, even 2 years is crazy. It took me 2 years to do just these 2 books, you know, when you look at it. I can't imagine the stress they must be under.
Well, and I think it's, you know, it's one thing to is to get these out, but it's the expectations, you know. You know, if you put something out and it's so-so, you know, people say, yeah, it's okay. But right. This is people, you're like, I waited for a year and you still don't have this right?
Yeah.
Or yeah. Not
Shigeru
a year.
Miyamoto said that a bad game is bad forever, but a late game is late once.
Yeah, that is interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it goes. So yeah, they got quite a bit in there. I do love a lot of the stuff with the Mothership. It's just some of the ones some of them are hard to read is where my main issue is. But that'd be nice when it comes out. I've never actually played any Mothership games.
I've ran it like 5 or 6 times now. And it's always fun, even if I don't get to kill anybody. I ran Gradient Descent. Other than like flipping through the book casually, I was literally able to run the book, just sit down and run it from the book without having like detailed prep it at all. Like I'd only like casually read the book and be like, oh, I like this room. Oh, this encounter's cool. Oh, this is neat. And then I put it away for like, you know, 6 months or whatever. And then one night, one player couldn't make it last minute and everybody else was already at my house. And I was like, you guys want to play Mothership? And without having read the thing in 6 months, I opened it up and I went, okay, you guys start here. Here's the map.
I find that I don't think I really care for percentile systems either.
It's the roll under that gets me is really the thing.
It may be that for me too. I don't know why, but it for and it doesn't make any sense. It just seems like it still just doesn't feel right. I don't know what it is.
I got really into Cyberpunk 2020 for about a month and lost my life to that earlier this year. And that's a D10 plus modifier system.
I think the part of the problem is I don't know that the gradient given to you, granularity given by a percentile. Yeah. Like, why can't we just do a D20 and just go up by 5%? Like, you're gaining nothing by having a 63% skill in this, a 41% skill in this, a 69%. Like,
nice.
This is offering to me little value in creating, and maybe it's dealing with larger numbers.
Yeah, I've heard this complaint about Call of Cthulhu also. Although in that one, it's more that some of your specific skills that you get trained in only offer like really granular bonuses.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of, I think in general, a lot of more modern games. I think there's just been a lot of great innovations to, the old innovation was, we'll go back to BX where you just, it's very simple and your characters die real easy. And there's not a lot of rules to more modern mechanics that can do complex things or emulating genres in a way that is satisfying without requiring, looking up, 27 skills to figure out which one you want to apply, find where it is in that list. It's just, I find that also annoying.
The funny thing is, everybody was going back to BX for so long that I got bored and started going and looking at people who are hacking OD&D. Let's go further back.
Oh yeah, no, I think it all. Right now I've started doing a Worlds Without Number game, partly to. Because I have a friend who thinks he thinks that the older systems are pretty boring. There's not much mechanically to play with. He likes playing with things mechanically, and there's really not a lot of juice with OSE.
He likes options.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I got a lot of players that are like that. That's why they like 5e, because there's just a shitload of options.
Yeah. To me, the problem is I think in order for it to have that complexity, other things need to be pared down and changed drastically, and they didn't do that.
And sometimes by offering options to the players, like, oh, you can hit people with your shield if you take this feat or this subclass or this whatever, this fighter option, that by definition means nobody else can shield bash now because you took the special option, and that, removes that,
right.
Like, removes that from the pool.
Yeah, and so far, I mean, we're working through the second. We only done two sessions of Worlds Without Number, but it seems to have a number of really kind of good things going for it. We'll see how it plays out. But the shock damage was pretty brutal, because you can miss and damage will still be done. And so if a Mokhtar is coming at you with an axe and he misses and he still does 3 points of damage to you.
Yeah, that could be your guy because the hit points are still like BX style, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you're giving you, if you're a fighter, a D6 plus two.
Wow.
So, but what's interesting is it creates a style of play, though. It's how play is, I think, with D&D, with 5th edition, it's high fantasy and ultra heroic. And
right. I always say it's fantasy Avengers.
It really is. It really is. And what brings that true is I had a friend who loved Iron Man. I mean, he's for his entire life has loved Iron Man. And every game he's ever played, he's tried to make a version of Tony Stark. And is it the, what's, I don't know my 5th edition.
It's
what's
the Artificer. There's an armor or artificer subclass, which basically it lets you meld your armor to your body.
Yeah.
And basically become Iron Man.
Yeah.
My wife is running a Spelljammer game right now, and we have a goblin who's an armor or artificer. And so he was like, can my armor be a mech suit? So he's this little tiny goblin in this huge mech suit. And I'm an 8-foot tall hippo man with a gun. So
who are you to say no, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's all legitimate, but it does go to show how super heroic. And I think what's the one that can, you know, especially with 5th edition, where you can think you can just go pew, pew, pew all day long as a magic user, as a cantrip?
Firebolt. Basically, warlocks get Eldritch Blast. Everybody basically gets any one damage cantrip, which I never had a problem with because it's like, well, the fighter gets to swing his sword all day. Why can't I?
Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah. But here's the thing. They inflate the hit point number so much in that game to account for it, too, is the thing. Like an owlbear in BX has like 22 hit points, whereas one in 5e has like 55 or something like that.
You know, and I think it goes back to, you know, adjusting the dials. You know, what's more satisfying? Is it hitting more often and doing, you know, relatively small amount of damage, or hitting less often and doing relatively more damage? And I think most people would rather hit more often and take little chunks out, but then to at least a 2 or 3 hour, you know, combat.
Well, it can. I really have gotten, my group is really good about this. We can do like a regular style combat against like 4 or 5 guys in like a half hour.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
When I ran that OSC at the con, nobody really played the old school essentials, and they were just shocked how fast combat went.
Yeah.
And I think also too, I think there's a lot of stuff that's just kind of ruling. I want to do this, I want to do that, and I kind of weigh it out and say, okay, you know, if you want to try that, you got to make this roll. This is what happens if you fail. Okay, boom, you know, it's done. So you know, it was less of, you know, having to figure things out. You know, what one guy, his desire was to try and shoulder somebody. It was a con game, so why not? He's trying to shoulder this guy into the pit and then throw his javelin and at the big bad guy. Like, okay. Rolled it, hit the first guy. If you hit him, you can knock him in the pit. I said, but then you got to make a roll versus Dex, roll under, or you fall in the pit too.
Right.
Off of the pit he goes.
Yeah. Yeah, Space Cowboy is really, really good for that, because the partial success mechanic from PBTA, having something in the middle that is like, okay, you did the thing, but then there's a complication or something goes wrong or you take a little bit of damage, really opens up the possibilities for what can happen when you try to do something. I mean, the way that we mechanize shooting is, it's called getting a firefight in our game. And basically, by definition, then, if you start shooting at someone, they're going to shoot back. So by definition, taking a risk and shooting at somebody means you take the risk of getting shot yourself. And it immediately ups the stakes on that.
Yeah, I not played it, but one, I think there's, is it Magpie Games? I get my game companies mixed up. They had one called Cartel.
Okay.
And basically, if you pull out a gun, there's a move, and it's, I think it's something like somebody gets bleeping shot or something. It's some explicative of being shot. So once a gun's pulled out, just the act of, once that move is made, people are going to die.
Right.
It's like there's no going back and forth. We're going to resolve this quickly, and it's going to be somebody's going to the morgue or the hospital.
Yeah.
At least one person. It's like, and I kind of like that idea too, where it's you can play around, pussyfoot around, and but you know, once you pull that gun out, that things are going to happen. So the same thing with the Space Cowboy here, which is great. And I do think. To me, every GM should run Dungeon World or one of the Apocalypse World games at least a few times. I think
you should try and at least read. Maybe not everybody has enough time to play everything, but you should at least read as many games as you can get your hand on and that you're interested in. Because you can, I buy and read so many games, even games that I'm only like kind of interested in, because there's going to be that one thing in there that I'm going to go, oh, but that rule, give me that. Give me those foraging rules. I don't care about the whole rest of this, but your foraging rules are cool. Let's take those and put them in my big-ass document of stupid house rules that only I ever look at.
Well, to me, the 2d6 with a 6 or lower being failure in a move against the character, 7 through 9 being a partial success, and 10 plus being a full success, you can shorten up any situation the characters want to go into. If you're saying, I don't want to play this all out, so roll 2d6, add a modifier, and we'll use that mechanic for anything.
Yeah, the ability for the GM to stretch out or zoom in on moments and make that one roll constitute as much or as little time as the narrative needs it to is really underrated as far as I'm concerned in all games.
Yeah, and I think what helped me out was even though I hacked it, I didn't want to play the full version, but Blades in the Dark, where you basically would roll, you come up with you'd have like your crew would get together, you come up with a basic plan on what you're going to do for this job, and you'd roll to see how far you get before all of a sudden your characters get activated. So how far along, and does anything bad happen along the way? And then you cut right to wherever that moment is without having to, you know, okay, we go buy some rope, we go buy
come in late and get out early.
Yeah, exactly.
Screenwriting advice there. Start as close to the action as you possibly can.
Yeah, yeah. So no, that's good. And I think you know, that system is, you know, it's popular for a reason, and it's pretty robust.
I think if, like, because even though we ran the Kickstarter in early 2021, I had started writing CU Space Cowboy in like late 2019. And I got stuck on like two little things on it and sort of just put it on the shelf while I thought about other things. Because that's actually how my process creatively has always been for everything. Like when I was a musician, I would come up with two or three lines for a song or a guitar riff or something like that. And I would be like, this riff is good. I'm just going to leave it, but I can't figure out where to go with it. So I'm just going to leave it in my head and just mentally play it over and over while I'm at work or driving home or doing whatever until the next part of it emerges in my mind, until I figure out what to do with this. And then the next time I'll pick up my guitar, the next riff will come out. And so, you know, that's what happened. I didn't know what to do with these two mechanics. And so I just thought about it until I figured out what to do with it about a year later. And I would, you know, every couple months I would come back to it and be like, does this work? And I would sort of run a test session with some friends or do something. And I go, no, that didn't work either. Back to the drawing board. Got to think about it more. So I got stuck on those. I think if I had started developing it in like 2020 over the pandemic, maybe like 6 months or 8 months later, and known about Blades in the Dark, I'm not sure when that came out, but it feels like right around then. At least that's when I started hearing about it. CU Space Cowboy would probably be a Blades in the Dark hack.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more, I think it's a little bit better refined for, it feels better for long-term play. I don't know why. But it's definitely kind of just a still a derivative of that, but using a little bit different mechanics, which.
Yeah. Regarding long-term play, CU Space Cowboy is like explicitly designed to be a shorter term game. I mean, Cowboy Bebop is the reference point. Cowboy Bebop had one season and it was 26 episodes and they never made anything else. That's not true. They made a Netflix show that I thought was pretty okay. And they made a movie in 2001 that was kind of like, I mean, the movie was great, but I mean, like, canonically, it was like, it just took place between two episodes and then that was it. Like, you didn't even need to see it in context to see the rest of the series.
I've not seen the anime, but I did watch several episodes of the Netflix series. I thought for the limitations that they had, they did a very good job. And I thought all the actors were very good.
It had a great fucking cast. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear. Am I allowed to swear on here?
That's okay.
It had a great cast. I thought, you know, the music, they got the original composer and band back to do the music. So all the new music was great. I thought the vibe of it was really cool. And they made some really bold choices with the ending of it that really, like, would have made a season 2 different. I think, because number one, I don't think there was going to be more than a two seasons of that show to begin with. I think they were like, we're going to make two seasons and then we're done. And so I think that second season, they really could have corrected some of the mistakes that, or perceived mistakes that some people had with the show, and maybe righted the ship a little more and really done something interesting. And then it would be done. And we could have just like had it and enjoyed it. But no, they canceled it after one season.
Yeah. And I know a lot of some fans were all, you know, been out of shape about, you know, this or that. But I think it just probably just in general just didn't captivate a large enough audience to warrant it a second season.
Yeah.
But it had a lot of character, a lot of vibe, and a lot of heart. You know, you see a lot of these shows, sometimes these shows, just there's a lot of heart. It's just, but still just not enough sometimes.
Yeah. I think it was too expensive too. I think they spent a whole lot of money on it and it didn't pan back out. But, you know, they have boatloads of money. That's what this strike is all about.
Oh, yeah. Lots of money. Yeah, it is strange. The whole movie industry, directions it takes, the choices they make. You know, I've also wondered if they could just scale down the budgets and just make better stories. How much?
Yeah, that's the thing, man. They're like, the next Batman movie is going to cost $200 million. I'm like, in what world does a Batman movie need to cost more than like $30 million?
Yeah,
you know, it's a guy in a costume punching gangsters. What are you doing?
Well, I think the problem I have with the Batman is I enjoyed the. I really enjoyed the pre-Frank. I like Frank Miller's Dark Knight, but I enjoyed the stuff in the 70s and where he was more of a
Denny
detective.
O'Neil stuff. Yeah.
But now just like somebody said, his superpower is depriving people of their civil rights. He said that really
hey, Gotham has the best universal healthcare system in America. That's why he's okay sending guys to the hospital.
He's doing him a favor. Somebody mentioned that it used to be he had more higher level technology than the police department had.
But now the police have the police have what Batman had in the 60s.
Yeah.
Real police. So basically all he is he's like a cop without jurisdiction.
Yes. Yeah. So the moral of the story they said now is, see, if we had less restrictions, how much more effective we'd be.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy watching them, but it's just like, there's a point where it's like, I don't.
Yeah, you can't. This is something that we kind of run up in a lot in Space Cowboy is because they're bounty hunters, right? They effectively do work for the police force, an inept and underfunded police force that, by definition, doesn't have the resources that these guys who have extra jurisdictional immunity or whatever, right? But part of the thing with the show is that a lot of these people, they're not criminals because they want to be. They have problems. They have situations. Most of the episodes of the TV show end with characters going, like they let them go because it's like, actually, your life is more important than the, you know, $3,000 I'm going to get for taking you in.
Right.
And you can lean into or as far away from that with your own game as you want to, but that creates challenges for us sometimes as creators with how much we lean into or against that. Because we want to make like a fun, tropey game that also is like, but all the corporations control this planet, so it's a horrible hellscape.
Right.
And so, you know, we have to wrestle with that sometimes, and trying to walk that line can be difficult.
Yeah, because I mean, some people, you know, all they just want to do is just blow off some steam, and they don't want moral consequences for.
Yeah,
we had
a long week. You know, my job sucks. I just want to come and roll dice and take care of guys who are robbing people with guns. That's like objectively bad. Let's take care of these guys.
But now you're making it so when I arrest him and put him away, all of a sudden he's got this orphan that's out there now.
He's actually robbing the banks to pay for his kid's sick thing. And it's like, now I feel bad and I have a moral dilemma. And I got to go to work later, man, because we're both on the night shift, you know?
Yeah, I think that is kind of an interesting thing to thread. And I suppose you could even do that. So I suppose you could even do that just up front in the beginning, say, here's three options, you know, one, you know, two and three, and just to have the adventure presented.
My other thing is I really believe that a good tabletop RPG campaign, like a long running game, and even a long running CU Space Cowboy game, is maybe we did 16 episodes of our podcast and then and everybody fulfilled their debt and resolved their regrets and whatever. Like, they all had their character arcs finished. So it really, like, is tight that way. But, like, over those 16 episodes, there were times where the bad guy was just a bad guy who he wanted to blow up the movie theater because he got fired.
Right.
And it's like, and at the end of the day, when they captured the guy, one of the players just said, cool motive, still a crime, though. You're going to jail.
Well, you know, you talk about this made me think of, have you seen City of Mist?
I have not. What is that?
So it's another Powered by the Apocalypse where it's kind of like your incarnations of some sort of aspect. And there's the human aspect and there's divine aspect. So it's kind of like, and the more you go to one, if you go too far.
I have looked at this.
No, so the more you go to one, you can become unplayable. You can become just such a, you lose all your mortality, not immortality, but your humanness is gone. Or you go the other way where you just forget who you were and you just become a normal human. But I thought what would be kind of interesting is you could do the, take the money or do you let the guy go? And that would factor one way or the other. So one way. Right. You know, do you lose heart and stop being a bounty hunter? Or the other one is, do you become so poor that you can't escape poverty now? And you're right, exactly.
Like you can't let all of them go away. We need to eat this week. We literally don't have enough fuel to get off of this planet anymore.
Yes. And as a GM, you could just make it progressively more of a morally difficult situation.
Yeah, yeah. But so, like I was saying, I think any good long-term campaign is, like, it's about oscillation. One week, this guy's just an asshole and you got to put him away. The next week, it's kind of a moral complication. And maybe that leads to, because you let that person go, they belong to an organization of really bad guys and now they're after you because they let that target go or whatever, and you build off of that. I say the same thing about like D&D campaigns. You have a like gritty dungeon crawl, and then maybe the week after that, the festival's in town.
Right.
You know, you variety is the spice of life, and within certain bounds of whatever you're doing, you just move up and down with on a macro and a micro level. I was just telling my wife because she wanted a secret door. Or something like that, and in the dungeon she was building. She's like, "What? How do I know what number it should be? How difficult should it be to find the secret door?" And I said, "Don't put a number to it. Just feel it out at the table, because at the moment you can decide at the moment they roll and check for the secret doors, how difficult is the secret door to find? And if we've been having a really shitty night where we've rolled really badly, then make it a really low number, like make it like a 9 to find the secret door. Or if we've been having really successful time and, you know, killing everything and haven't really had any challenges, maybe make it like a 15 or 16. So it's really hard to spot.
Yeah. Or you could go the Powered by the Apocalypse route and say, if you fail, you find the door only because something bad comes out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That too.
So if you find it, you open the door, secret door. If you don't, bugbears come out of that door.
Yeah. She would probably have a better time running a PBTA type game, but this is what she wanted to do because the new book came out and she loves the setting and space stuff and stuff like that.
Space stuff for what setting? For what game?
She's running a Spelljammer game in 5e.
Oh!
So that's why she's into that.
Yeah, and it's also interesting, the Worlds Without Number they use... you basically put how hidden something is, and then that's how many turns it takes to find it.
Yeah.
And then if you make time a resource, then
yeah, ticking clocks is a big thing too. In
yeah.
Some games.
So if you know,
we were
so you
trying
say,
to figure out like a small heist supplement that revolved around ticking clocks for Space Cowboy. We never really cracked it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think it's kind of hard because it'd probably be unique to the situation. In like Dungeon World, it's a good question. And that's something I've never really have done, but I mean, it's kind of interesting because you could, I think the idea of having clocks and then every time somebody, you know, takes their time doing something, you check a mark or you roll a die. I think it helps add to the tension.
Yeah. Some GMs use like a tension pool mechanic where it's like every time something bad happens, they add like a D6 to a bowl or something like that. And when there's so many D6s, they roll all of them. And if certain a number come up six or something like that, then something bad happens.
There's a lot of fun stuff out there.
Yeah. Here's the thing. You can hack whatever mechanics you want into your game. Cause nobody's going to send the Pinkertons to your house, or maybe they might, but
yes, just
make
sure
they're not going to come and destroy your books if you don't play the game the way they did it. So just do whatever works for your table.
Yeah. And I think too, it's like, and some things are kind of broken and, but as far as a personal level, like I think one of the things that a lot of people in the OSR like to do is they do a shield sundering. So if you get hit and you don't want to take that hit, you just have your shield get broken.
Yeah, you can tank the hit and break the shield.
But I was thinking about that, but that really does, it really does give a huge advantage to everybody that is a fighter, but really technically fighters should always be the ones up front taking the risks. So, you know, it probably all works out fine. Unless you're a bunch of thieves fighting a bunch of people with swords and they start doing that, or shields and they use that all day long, then that could be kind of ugly. So, but that's very cool. So you say the next one's going to be equipment guide?
It's called the Cybernetics Catalog. It's all about cybernetic upgrades for your characters. So you can upgrade your arms or your body, which includes your torso or your legs or your brain. You can get like a cyber brain installed. And then each one of those have a certain number of slots, which let you install what we call cyber modules. So it's basically like, okay, I have cybernetic arms. The cybernetic arms on their own don't do anything. They're just cybernetic arms. But if you have two cyber module slots, then you can buy different modules to get added in. Like you can get a module that would put a gun in your forearm. So now I have a machine gun in my forearm. I always have a machine gun, and you get the same bonus that you would as if you had a normal machine gun. It's in my arm now. Or I could get something that lets me have like a screwdriver in my arm, and now I can take stuff apart and put it back together and do stuff like that. Or I could put one in that gives me advantage on a roll to lift up heavy stuff, you know, stuff like that. That's probably the next thing we're going to do unless something else gets done first. But that's the next thing we're doing for Space Cowboy.
Well, that's exciting. At least you have a path, you have a project, and you even have an end, least a proposed end to this whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to do that, and we're going to do the adventure anthology, and there is a sort of dogfighting ship supplement floating around up here that I haven't cracked the code on.
That's a hard one to do. I don't know. And to me, the problem with ship combat is, I mean, the stakes are high.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but once we have all of that, which I estimate will probably be around 2025, once all that is done, we're gonna do the mothership thing. We're gonna collect it all in a box set and update it all and reprint it and have a nice big old box set that we're gonna call the first edition that you can buy and put on your shelf. And then once that first edition box set sells out, we're gonna make one hardcover, and that's gonna be where the game lives forever.
Oh, that's a good idea. I've thought about compiling certain things into hardbacks or doing something, but I think it makes it easier for you to fulfill, I think, in the future, and puts it at a price point that makes it easy for people to buy too.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Long term, it's like, you know, like Gary's Appendix, it's like, if I keep doing this, I mean, am I going to constantly be ordering a few more copies of issue 3 and issue 5, then issue 7, and some more copies of issue 19. I mean, like, Where's it end?
Right. Are you going to keep them in stock forever? Or are you going to be like, okay, I'm done doing these. The first six are going to live here, and then the next six are going to live here.
Yeah, I don't know. So, but I think that's that is definitely a solution to that. I don't know. I still have a ways to go before that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
But we'll see. So.
Yeah, I still need to get. I've been really busy. That's why I haven't gotten back to you about writing something for number four.
Well, I figured as much. It's okay. I got people. Number four, I got the cover commissioned, so it's coming along. I've got the bestiary all rough draft done, and I do one more pass and give it to editing, and just wait for the articles to flow in. And smart.
Wait.
Yeah. So, but anyway, if something changes at the last minute, and you got some capacity, let me know.
Yeah, I'll see what happens.
It's sword and sorcery is the theme for this one.
Yeah. Maybe I'll figure something out. We'll see.
Okay. An idea will hit you in the middle of the night and be like, okay.
So yeah. Yeah. 2 a.m. while I'm putting a pallet full of cheese crackers on the shelf.
That sounds exciting. Well, somebody's got to do it, I guess.
Yeah.
So you don't work for peanuts, you just work for cheese crackers. So
yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, thanks again, and I'll have you back on to get some time on slot.
Yeah, can I plug my stuff?
Oh yeah, feel free.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You can find everything at tidalwavegames.com. There's links to our physical store where I will send you books from my house. Buy my stuff, get this out of my house. We also have links to the DriveThruRPG and the itch.io there. You can pick up the core rulebook for See You Space Cowboy. I can say award-winning. It won an award. It won the Golden Tentacle from those guys at Wandering Monster Podcast. I need to update the page to say that. Or you can pick up the brand new Saris, the Planet That Never Sleeps. 40 pages, 36 locations, 18 bounties, 16 tables. That's a lot of numbers.
You did good.
Or if you want a Cyberpunk 2020 retro clone that we didn't even talk about, I have a View from the Edge 2023 Ashcan Edition. There's only like six of these left. Get them out of my house because I'm not printing anymore.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, well, you heard him. Stop by on Slot 6's various spots and pick up those zines. Because he needs space to put more robots up on his shelf.
Yeah. I got new stuff coming tomorrow. It's going to be a huge... I don't even know where I'm going to put it.
Well, the nice thing is the wife probably can't tell if there's more added.
Yeah.
What do you mean, honey? I've always had this many.
Yeah, I've always had this guy. You never see him?
All right. You take care.
Yeah, stay gold, folks.